Folks, are you tired of people telling you your band is too darn loud when you're just trying to practice in your house or garage? Well, if you live in Austin, I have the solution for you. That's Space Rehearsal and Recording. Space is a state-of-the-art affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. They have 31 spacious rooms, great PAs, fantastic courteous staff. They have everything you need to get your artistic business together at Space. Find them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com and start playing as loud as you want in Space Rehearsal and Recording. Let's get down. Hey gang, are you new to this podcast? Have you subscribed on Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts and realized that you can only access the 20 most recent shows on these platforms? Do you, my friend, want to binge on How Did I Get Here? Well, check out our archives that are available on the Podbean app. If you follow us on the Podbean app, we have every single show ever released on that platform. You'll also get all of your favorite shows like Fresh Air, WTF with Marc Maron, ID10T, the Michelle Obama podcast. All podcasts available there, and you can also access over 1,000 How Did I Get Here episodes. So download the Podbean app from your app store and start listening today. Let's get down.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Howdy.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a good weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. People seem to be getting out a little bit more and enjoying the world a little bit. We had some really nice weather on Saturday. There was a lot of people on the trail. I avoided it. It was huge groups, like six people on the trail. Things seemed to be opening up. I went to a show on Sunday night. I went to Antone's to see my friend Brandon Temple and James Robinson in Temple Underground. They're starting this new tour, New Dawn. Their New Dawn tour. They kicked it off at Antone's in Austin on Sunday night, and I was fortunate enough to go. And I have to tell you guys, something amazing happens when you're in the same room as the people making the music. You know, it was incredible. At one point I was actually moved to tears, and the music is so good too. Like that, you know, that what they do is in the moment. They're feeling things. They're calling things out as they're about to change. Brandon calls it out. It's really exciting when that happens. I don't know if that happens, if that's exciting to people that aren't musicians, but to a musician, it's really exciting to watch. I mean, fucking exciting. He ran the whole show from behind the drums. He's such an amazing drummer. So beyond what you normally get to hear. You know what I mean? As an artist behind a drum set. You don't normally think of it like that, do you? Well, he is. He's an artist behind the drum set. Just an amazing, amazing creator. James sang great. The band was fantastic. D Madness playing the bass. Unbelievable. He had a great guitar player and keyboard player whose names I didn't get. But my friend Chandra Washington, who was on the show last year, she danced throughout the thing. She'd wear weird costumes with like a fucking light on her head. It was unbelievable. And I was moved to tears at one point. I was just moved to tears. I don't know exactly what it was. Maybe it's because I do this. I want to be around it. I want to hear people make music. And hearing music that was so good and in the moment, It moved me to tears. And it was like going to school and going to church at the same time. I wrote that to Brandon and James last night after the show. I felt like I went to church and to school at the same time. But it felt so good. It was the church part that made me like open up. I felt like it opened up inside me, and my eyes welled up with tears. And I cried as I watched my friends play. It was unbelievable. He had amazing openers too. Jaron Marshall from Black Pumas, who's been on the show a couple times over the last year. Great conversations with that guy. Amazing keyboard player. He came out and did like three songs. This woman, Ivy Root, who was amazing as well. And there was a woman who was Hispanic that I couldn't really see her because I was sitting kind of behind on the side of the organ, which is where I wanted to be because the keyboard player was fucking awesome in Temple Underground. Anyway, they're heading out on tour. You can look up Brandon Temple. You can go back and listen to the show that I did with him last week. A quick conversation about the tour and about making music and stuff. I bought a t-shirt. I was excited. I was excited to be there. I was so glad to be there. You know, my girlfriend Terry had a great time. She enjoyed it. She thought, you know, she was like, blown away at like the musicality of the whole thing. I want to thank them for having me as their guest. It was great. Just great. Seeing friends, being at a place, hearing music in the same room with the people making it. It was like magic. Magic, I tell you. Gang, I have a great show for you today. Black Americana artist from Harlem, New York, Queen Esther, is my guest on the show today. She's got a new album out called Gild the Black Lily that is gorgeous. You can find her at queen-esther.com. Now, she was born in Atlanta and she grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. And then she came to University of Texas to study and ended up getting in with the Esther's Follies crowd and started doing that kind of stuff. And then ended up in Rotel and the Hot Tomatoes, if you know that band from here in Austin. And then she moved to Harlem and joined the Black Rock Coalition. She's done TED Talks on the origins of country and bluegrass music. Just fantastic conversation. She's super interesting. I do have to say this one thing, that our Zoom connection was not good. And there were 9 parts where it froze. But I went out and I took them out. So there'll be times when all of a sudden you'll kind of come in the middle of a sentence. But I think you'll follow it. And it was a great conversation. She's a really, 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 really talented person. And I really enjoyed talking to her. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Black Americana artist from Harlem, New York, Queen Esther. Let's get down.
Cowboy life doesn't suit me. Punching doggies isn't easy.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing good. And you're in New York. Where in New York are you?
I'm in Harlem. I'm in West Harlem.
Oh, nice. My cousin is moving there.
To where?
I think they're looking for a place in Harlem because she's going to be working at a hospital. She's an OBGYN.
There are several different Harlems. So depending on... there's Central Harlem, there's Harlem Strong, which is what black people call a particular neighborhood in Harlem. There's Sugar Hill, there's the East Side, which is totally different from where I live. I live all the way on the West Side by the water.
Okay.
I live next to Riverbank State Park.
Okay.
Land that goes all the way up to the Palisades.
Oh, wow.
And it's really lush and green and pretty and sunny and beautiful. And it feels suburban, kind of, but at the same time, it's the city. It's considered to be one of the safest neighborhoods in the city, if not the safest, because you've got City College right here in Columbia and Baruch and Barnard. They're all clustered together right in this little pocket, and it's mostly just families, Mexican, Dominican. I mean, some people call it the little Dominican Republic.
Oh, nice.
But that's my little pocket.
Right.
You know,
who knows where they'll be. I don't know it well enough to know. Yeah.
Yeah. If she's down the hill, she's going to be where the quote unquote action is. There's lots of, restaurants and cafes and stuff like that. I mean, not that there's none up here, but there's way more down there.
Right.
You know?
Right. So Esther, your connection to Austin is that you went to college here and then you stayed here afterwards playing music, right?
No. What happened was I went to college there and then I thought, well, I want to be a performer, and the university wasn't casting me and stuff. I mean, I didn't want to sing. I sang because I thought, well, this is something that I do and that I do well that's extra. So I guess I could do this when I'm not acting, but I really just wanted to be an actor. And I didn't even want to necessarily be a film actor or a television actor. I just wanted to do theater. I didn't think that I was pretty enough to do on-camera work, but I knew that I had stage presence and I knew that I could do theater really, really well. I knew that was my lane, and so I'm going to stick to it. So when I wasn't getting cast, I thought, well, I'll just go out in the city and see what's going on. And that's when I started singing my brains out. But that wasn't my plan. And right. I was doing that while I was going to school.
Right.
Stuff's just started happening. You know, things just started. It's like, well, I never really said no to any opportunity. I was doing theater with Boyd Vance.
Right.
You know, at Capital City Playhouse. And Boyd was a genius. He was a genius. When he was running around with Shannon Sedgwick, who started Esther's Follies, it was a skit that he did where he was pretending to be Tina Turner that started Rotel and the Hot Tomatoes. That's how they started.
Really?
They were the Ikeettes behind him.
Right, right.
When he stepped off as, you know, doing his little Tina Turner skit that was supposedly hilarious, they thought, well, we can just keep this party going. So it was a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead, and they had a 5-piece band. And they're still touring.
Yeah.
From what I understand, they're still, like, running around and doing that.
Wow. And what's the genre of music they do? Like Tina Turner and then, like 60s and 70s, like soul music or something?
You mean Rotel?
Yeah.
Rotel was girl group stuff. From the 60s, I guess, the 50s and the 60s. It was all of that yuppie stuff that everybody liked. You know, Baby, I'm Yours and the Supremes and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, but we could, you know, shift gears and do just about anything because the three of us sang harmony really well and the band was like top notch. So we did a lot of private parties
right.
that wanted this particular take or that, you know. We did a lot with the Bass Brothers. We did the Zoo Ball. We did the White Ball. We did private parties for H. Ross Perot. We did a lot of stuff. We opened for the Temptations, for the Four Tops.
That's awesome.
Chuck Berry. Yeah. You know. And I also, before I was with them, I sang with Moving Parts.
Right.
I remember when we opened for Larry Carlton. I remember when we opened for Crowded House. So I did a lot of stuff before I left Austin. And by the time I left Austin to move to New York, I was making a living at it. I was paying my rent, paying my bills, keeping my student loan creditors at bay. And living by myself. And I managed to live by myself in a pretty cool apartment in West Campus with a piano. Wow. I mean, I guess I could have kept going that way, but I really wanted more.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like a comfortability to Austin that, you know, you can.
Yeah.
I mean, the next you don't have to leave if you don't want. Yeah.
You really don't. You know, I was crazy in love with someone who was moving to New York and I wanted to go to New York. So it seemed really opportune that we were going at the same time, Jack Spratt. And he got to New York maybe 6 months before I did. He graduated in business administration, got a job as an accountant in New York and, you know, he got an apartment in the Lower East Side and I moved to Harlem. And for a little while, I lived in the Upper West Side, but I've mostly lived in Harlem.
Yeah.
So it's a weird kind of, my arc is weird because once I got here, it was just me staying in a perpetual state of discomfort, of not comfort, like out of my head, out of my element, off my off kilter, dancing on the head of the pin. Forever, for always. Like, I can't, there are very few moments where that has not been true, where I have not been completely out of my element and flying by the seat of my pants.
What are those moments where you're not?
I mean, it's just a constant. I don't even know how to explain it. God, why can't somebody just give me a freaking break?
Yeah.
But that never happened. And I just never quit. I never, you know, took my ball and packed my things and went home. I just never did that. I can remember the first really horrible snowstorm in New York. And it was really bad. And after everything thawed out, a lot of people that I knew went home. They just left. They were like, there was a place called Spaghetteria in Chelsea, and they made an igloo in the front of their building, and people were lining up to go into the igloo and have dinner.
Jesus.
It was really bad. And after that thawed out, everybody was like, you know what? I'm going to go back to UT and go to graduate school. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to go be a nurse. You know, yeah. Everybody had another plan of action. I stayed. So when they got married or they had kids, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know.
Hmm. So is that when you put out that first Talking Fishbowl Blues record?
Something like that. I mean, I had all these ideas and I had all these songs. And Jack, at the time, who was no longer my boyfriend, but we were partners creatively. And I was like, you know, we've been doing these songs. We should make a record. But I've been reading all these books about how to make a record. And I thought, well, the work doesn't end after you finish the record in the studio. There's all this stuff that has to happen after you're done. You have to get a publicist and a radio promoter or figure out how to do those things yourself and get your record out there into the world. And so often, more often than not, musicians stop right there when the record is recorded. They're just like, okay, you know, I did it.
Yeah, it's like, right.
You almost did it.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. They just kind of stop there. A lot of people I know stop there. And if they know someone, if they happen to know someone, then maybe there's a review here or there. No, I went out with an onslaught. And that's when I read some article or a book about guerrilla marketing. And it said, hey, if you think of a name for yourself or your genre, then it makes it easier for people to understand what you do. So that's when I started calling it Black Americana.
But that's what it is, right? I mean,
that is what it is. But I got into this weird argument with him at the time. He was like, that's an oxymoron. Americana's already black. But I'm like, people don't really think of it that way.
No.
And I've got a lot of polite pushback. I mean, everyone was overly critical. There were certain things that they couldn't come at me for, like the fact that I could actually sing. So there was a kind of begrudging, you know, critical kind of giving it up.
Right.
But at the same time, kind of weird pushback on how dare you be in this room that is country music? How dare you be in this room that is Americana? Something interesting and something different to the table. I think they just hoped, okay, she's done this. She's not signed to a major label. Let's hope she goes away. And I didn't.
No.
Am I babbling?
No. I feel like I'm babbling. No, the thing is you keep freezing. And so I'm going to have to edit some of this stuff out, but I'm sure you're saying important things that I'm missing. I hate Zoom, Esther. I hate it. I wish you could come over and do this here in my house. But anyway, look, we'll get through this. I do understand what you're saying. I could see how the pushback is there. Although you look at people that predate any white real Americana, like people that would call themselves Americana, but like Blind Boys of Alabama or something. Like, isn't that, I mean, I know it's gospel and stuff, but that, to me, gospel, blues, and sort of music rooted in that world is what Americana is.
Yeah, but there's a certain sound and a certain twang and a certain approach that I'm not supposed to touch, that I'm not supposed to be privy to or embrace, when the truth is I created it. Yeah. That twang is a kind of dissonance that is African in origin. Yeah. And we can talk to ethnomusicologists or what have you about that, about what, and we can, you know, dissect that. But at the core of it is someone who's really uncomfortable with the idea of me saying any of this or even having this conversation.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah.
Or at least that's where it hit the road when I started.
Your record.
Then I started digging into.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, it's I was okay. going to say your Gild the Black Lily is a gorgeous record, and it's available now wherever people stream and download their music. That's the record that I heard that Joe Ray sent to me. And my girlfriend, I was like, oh, I got this to listen to. And she's like, oh, play it. And so I played it, and we just kept listening to it. It was just your
wow, that's so cool.
Regardless of any genre or anything, you're an amazing songwriter and just a great singer. But what I was going to say to you is, you gave a TED talk on the origins of country and bluegrass. I didn't see that, but how did you get involved with having such a great understanding of it that you can talk about it? Like,
well, I think as a theater actor, you're constantly researching. Research is really important, and it's a really great way to extend your creativity, intellectually. And it's good to explore all of these things. So I just started, you know, researching in another direction. When I'm acting and I'm doing theater and I'm building a character, I have to do a lot of research and I have to find my source material. So I just did that with music.
That's amazing.
I just started digging, started excavating, started reading lots of really wonderful scholarship on Americana, Black Americana, the banjo, radio, pop music, and really the fundamentals of where all this began and how it all started.
What did you find out about that? Like, where did it come from?
I found out that once upon a time, we all listened to music, that we didn't necessarily have television or anything to entertain ourselves. So we entertained each other by singing to each other and playing instruments. And this kind of thing was a kind of pastime amongst friends and family. And it wasn't unusual for someone to be a really great musician and to go out and make extra money with that kind of thing as right. they went along.
Right.
I found out that Black women, more often than not, with a lot of great bluesmen, their first teachers were their mothers. Because back in the day, when you would woo someone, if you were my suitor, right. you would come over and I would make pie and we would sit in a drawing room and I would play an instrument. And more often than not, that would be a parlor guitar.
Right.
So their first instrument, their first introduction to the instrument was through their mothers. I found out that the history of the banjo extends to Black women in Africa for more than 10,000 years. And I found out that once we were here and we had that fork in the road with the music that we all loved and enjoyed and listened to, it wasn't until someone came along and said, I got to sell this. I got to figure out how to sell this. I know. I'll sell it to the white people and call it hillbilly music. And I'll sell it to the Black people and call it race music. Because we've got to sell it. We've got to sell it somehow. This is all marketing and promotion. This doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what I like or what you like. Because before somebody came along to sell it, it was just music. And there was a lot of overlap with listener appreciation, a lot of overlap with the recordings. Some of the earliest hillbilly albums were performed by jazz musicians, black jazz musicians, actually. Many of them nameless and faceless, but typical. You have to remember Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman. Well, that's Louis Armstrong and his wife, Lil Armstrong, on those recordings, those seminal recordings that were just the apex of country music and at the heart, at the crux of what any purveyor of country music will tell you is their foundation. And there's Louis Armstrong and his wife.
Right.
That was typical. That's just the way things functioned. And a lot of the hillbilly performers were black. They just did not put their picture on the album cover because they were marketing them to you. You know, it was a great audience for country music amongst black folk. Lots of older black folk that I knew listened to country music. And eventually, I mean, no one, you know, in the younger generation necessarily understood it, but, you know, it's what they were raised with. And to their ear, you know, the ones who are at the core, the foundation of bluegrass, they all had Leslie Riddle going to black communities and pulling the songs that would become, you know, what they were known for throughout the world. I don't know that this is necessarily anything that everyone knows, but after a certain point, I realized as I was talking to my friends that this is navel gazing. I need to step outside of my circle and tell this to other people who don't necessarily know this. So that's when the idea of speaking became a step forward, you know, became a good idea. And then I applied for the TED residency and got that and did that. I mean, I only had 8 minutes. I wish I had an hour. I could have done a lot more damage.
Yeah.
Are you getting all of this?
What happened was I lost you for like a whole minute. But once we came back, you were still going. I know. It's neither of our faults. It's technology's fault.
It is. It's technology.
It is.
Am I frozen?
No, you're not frozen. No. No, you're good. So
I mean, the upshot really is that all of it is resting comfortably on the shoulders of black people, African captives, black Americans, and specifically black women. And I don't know how to say that any more plain, but at the same time, that's nothing that nothing that most people have been taught. And so it's, you know, a strange conversation to have sometimes when you're giving someone this information and everything in them is telling them that it's not true, because when they turn on the Country Music Awards or the Country Music Channel, or they go check out country music or whatever, they're not necessarily seeing anyone that looks like me.
No.
And when they do, they think that it's an anathema, or it's just a moment that's going to pass.
Right.
Or a trend.
Right.
I mean, America's not really very good with its own history in general. So I can't expect it to be on the ball when we start getting specific.
Right, right. You know, that leads me. Do you know a guy named Bevis Griffin?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Name sounds familiar, but I don't know.
I saw that you joined the Black Rock Coalition. And I know
a while ago.
I know that whenever it was starting, like when Vernon Reed and whoever else was kind of getting it going, if I'm not mistaken, like in the late 80s or something. That he was around then during that time. I guess he and Vernon are still good friends.
I wasn't here then.
Okay. Anyway, I didn't know if you might have known him from Austin, because he's a guy from Austin that lived in New York for a while. But do you think that's part of what you're talking about, is spreading that message? That's part of what the Black Rock Coalition does as well?
Yeah, I think there are a great deal of assumptions all the way across the board that gets you hamstrung if you're Black and you're making music that isn't what's expected of you.
Right.
So, I mean, that's just par for the course.
Right.
I think that there's some sort of... there was a group in Nashville that was formed of Black country music performers who were like, you know, we're frustrated and we want a place to play and sing and do and be ourselves.
So back in the 80s and 90s, you were saying something.
Yeah. I don't remember. Yeah, I wasn't here then. I wasn't here in the 80s.
No. I know. But you just started saying something. That's when I lost you. You were saying back in the 80s and 90s.
Oh,
that's the last thing I made.
I think back in the 80s and 90s, Black country music performers in Nashville put together some sort of a collective to advocate for themselves and to find places where they could perform and build an audience and build a following. But I don't remember the name of it specifically or what happened to them.
Yeah, because the only people that I know, I mean, I'm not like a deep country guy, but the only people I know are like Charlie Pride and Darius Rucker. There's got to be more guys than that, right?
There's a ton.
I mean, also,
there's a ton.
I'm not in the world of country music. So, but in...
Well, look at it this way. You know, in Harlem, for example, in the 20s and 30s, if you went to a rent party, you would hear a string band.
Right.
You were likely to hear a string band. And everybody would be dancing to that.
Right.
And that would be a Black string band. There were lots of Black string bands up here from the South who just took their sound and just, you know, shifted with the Great Migration North.
Yeah. But with your research, how before you researched all this country music stuff, how did you come across it and why did it affect you?
I grew up with it. I grew up watching Hee Haw like everybody else. You know, I grew up watching, you know, Buck Owens and his Buckaroos. And, you know, I grew up watching specials by, you know, Matt Davis.
Right.
And, Loretta Lynn and Conway Twitty and all the duets they did. I mean, you turned on the television down south, you were going to see a lot of Tammy Wynette and George Jones. You just were.
Right, because you were in Atlanta and Charleston.
I was in Atlanta and Charleston, but Hee Haw was nationwide,
yeah.
And it was a really big deal.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just Hee Haw. I mean, I grew up with my great-grandparents, and I grew up with my grandparents on my mother's side. My father was born in 1917. He had 12 brothers and sisters. They were all from the South. And it wasn't specifically country music. It was a time when everybody was playing everything because it sounded good and they liked it.
Right.
The radio wasn't segregated.
Right.
You know, it wasn't segregated. And you also had a lot of really great live music performances on television. You could watch Soul Train. You could watch American Bandstand. You could watch Midnight Special. You could watch Don Kirshner's rock concert if you stayed up late at night.
Yeah.
I mean, there were live and people really on late night television. And then there was the Mike Douglas show. There was lots of live stuff happening on Mike Douglas show. I would come home from school and I'd put on cartoons and then the Mike Douglas show would come on and then the news would come on and then we'd have dinner.
Right.
I was always on the couch watching Mike Douglas, watching somebody scat, watching somebody tell a weird story, watching somebody, you know, hold the audience in the palm of their hand, watching Engelbert Humperdinck, watching all kinds of crap.
I watched all those same things. My favorite shows, like I loved Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin more than I loved the cartoons. For real.
Well, I mean, my mother would be like, turn that off. I want to watch, you know, Mike Douglas, and Blossom Dearie would be on.
Right. Or Scatman Crothers.
It's like, I'm a little kid. What do I know about Blossom Dearie?
Yeah.
I don't care, but my mother's like, oh, wait. And she would be transfixed, and I would just be like, oh, God, I can't believe I'm missing Bugs Bunny for this. But whatever, whatever, you know. And we would sit there and watch it, or she would be, and all of those songs. You know, I don't think there's anything like that now. I mean, you do have the internet. You do have the internet, and you do have cable. And the world is your oyster. It's really not about... Like if I bring up Blossom Dearie, someone will go, oh my gosh, how old are you? You know, you're, but it's like when you have access to everything and anything,
right?
It's, you know, the, you can just, you don't have to stay in one little corner. You can go in any direction.
Well, and when we were little kids, if you did watch those, like Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, you did see these people that were in their 60s or 70s at that point. You know what I mean? Because they were still kind of around. Bob Hope still had specials. George Burns was still a guy. Yeah.
I saw Alberta Hunter perform on the Mike Douglas show. I had no idea who she was. She was absolutely, she was a peach. She was adorable. And I think she might have been doing Cooking at the Cookery at that point. I don't even know. But, you know, I mean... It puts you in a very specific frame of mind. You know, a lot of people just find their one niche and they cling to it. And I don't mean to say that everything is my niche, but I'm just a very curious person. I'm interested in everything. I'm interested in people. It's like picking up a thread and you're just following the thread. You're following the trail on deep into the woods, and I will go as far as I possibly can with that one thread until I pick up another one and unravel something else. And as I'm unraveling that thing, I'm stitching together something that is completely different than what it was when I found it. I mean, that's pretty much my creative life in a nutshell. I don't necessarily like the idea of static. I feel like I'm a kind of shark that's always moving. And I'm always reading and experimenting and trying and baking things and failing up and trying again. You know, the pandemic happened and I realized, oh, I've got this Martin ukulele. So I started taking ukulele lessons. And then I wrote these songs, and I thought, well, these songs are about the pandemic. That's kind of weird. So I went in and I recorded them, and I'm going to put them out before the end of the year, I think.
So there's another record on top of this one.
There is another record. It's called Slow Days, Fast Times. I think that's what I want to call it. That's... But I decided to do a version of Bohemian Rhapsody. I thought, I want to sing this. But it's just my voice and a guitar. That's it.
That's amazing.
I think you'd like it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, it's just voice and guitar.
So when did you write the songs for Gild the Black Lily?
I wrote them a while ago, but you know, I'm broke. I don't have a record label. I don't have people throwing money at me. I have student loans. I have a life. I'm a musical theater performer, solo performer that's transitioning to on-camera work. So there's that. There's like all these other things that are happening in my life and I don't have any money. So I have to wait until all of those things come together, you know. And in the meantime, I'm just performing these songs and working these songs out, which I think is why, part of the reason why the album sounds as good as it does, because I've been performing those songs for years with those specific musicians.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's not like we got a hold of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like we got a hold of that song Oleander last week and thought, okay, we're going to rehearse this song for 2 or 3 days and then we're going to go in and record it. No, they've been playing that song with me around, you know, New York City or what have you for a while.
Where do you play there? Like Rockwood and places?
I played Rockwood. I played just about everywhere.
Yeah.
I love Jalopy because I love the proscenium art stage. I played at Joe's Pub. Before the pandemic hit, I actually had a gig at Joe's Pub that was supposed to happen in April. And I had another one for the hot vibe that I've got for Midsummer Night's Swing at Lincoln Center. That would have been a lot of fun. Mm. Yeah. So I do a lot of different kinds of music in a lot of different directions. I don't just do Black Americana. And when I do jazz, I've got this hot jazz set up. And then I sing with another hot jazz band called the Hot Toddies. And sometimes I perform with James Bloodomer. I love him dearly. Dearly. I can't even go into how much he means to me.
Why? I mean, why does he mean so much to you? Not why can't you go into it?
Why does he? Because I feel like he's a part of me. He comes from the same part of the South that I do. He's from St. Matthews, South Carolina. And when I met him, it felt like I was meeting someone that I was already related to, or someone that it just felt like we already knew each other. Mm-hmm. He felt so familiar. It was just one of those things where you're just already meeting someone that you already know.
Right.
It was just, we're just having to go through the formality of introducing ourselves.
Right.
Me right away, and he understood me very well. And that never happens.
Yeah.
That never happens. You hope that it happens. You hope that it's happening. You hope it happens more often.
Yeah.
That doesn't ever really happen.
So as far as acting goes, what is making you transition from the stage to film work?
Or money.
On camera work. Okay.
I can remember sitting around watching television, and I realized with every channel that I turned, I was looking at someone that I actually knew, that I'd worked with, that I'd done theater with, that I'd done a musical with, that I goofed off with, that I met at a party, or this or that or the other. And it was like, I felt like I was the last person picked for the baseball team.
Right.
And then I did a commercial for Prego, and I realized, oh, wow, I could be making a lot of money. And that money could be paying for all this other stuff I want to do. I mean, I did that commercial for Prego, and I lived off of that for like 2 years. There's gold in the Mar Hills.
Yeah.
But there are some adjustments that you have to make if that's what you want to do. I mean, there are certain adjustments you have to make if you want to go in any direction. So it's just like that.
Yeah. So you haven't done any Law & Order SVU yet?
No. I've had a million callbacks for that, but I haven't done it.
It seems like that would be like the slot that everyone that – all of my friends that live up there that act, that's their –
Yep.
Just got to get a couple of those. Yeah.
You know, it's still running, so maybe I'll get cast in it eventually, but...
I have a friend that's been on it twice as two different characters in different seasons.
I know people who've done that.
It's so wild.
I know people who've done that, yeah.
So, I read about you doing some one-person shows. Are those shows you wrote and had produced? And
yeah, that was me sitting around going, why am I auditioning for stuff and not getting it? I'll give myself a job. That's basically what happened. I would go in and I'd go audition for a Broadway show, and I get call back, and I wouldn't get it. And I'd be like, well, I can't just sit around, you know, waiting for the phone to ring.
Right.
I'll just write. And then I'll do my own theater. So that was me writing and producing or co-producing that stuff. I've got a show called Blackbirding that I did at Royal Family Theater last February before I went into a residency at Gettysburg National Military Park.
Oh, wow.
And that show, Blackbirding, which had original music and stuff, is basically about how the Civil War has never really ended and how that has impacted Black people. Blackbirding is basically the practice of just seeing a black person walking on the street, and you grab them. A free black person who's never been a slave, who's living in Schenectady or Pennsylvania or someplace up north, who's never known slavery, who just went out to run an errand for his mother, and he gets kidnapped, and he's in New Orleans.
Yeah.
He's a slave. I think that practice never ended. I don't think, you know, the Civil War ever ended. I think black people are still getting blackbirded. I think George Floyd got blackbirded.
Yeah.
I think when he walked into that store and he put his money down, he didn't think that guy would call the cops, which, interestingly enough, as it turns out, George Floyd wasn't guilty of what the man thought he was.
Right.
That money wasn't counterfeit. The check wasn't counterfeit. Everything was legit.
Right.
There was no reason for them to call the cops at all. That's blackbirding. He did not do anything wrong. Philando Castile got blackbirded, you know? So I tell these stories from the Civil War, and I sort of refract them into the present day. And there's ultimately, I'd like for there to be images and sound bites and you know, snippets of songs and music and, you know, all kinds of.
Yeah.
I froze, didn't I?
You did for a little bit. Oh, God, I'm sorry. It's not my fault. I wish it was, because I would punish myself in some way. I spent a lot of last summer talking to a lot of friends of mine. I had a friend of mine, James Robinson, this amazing singer and songwriter that's from here, reached out to me maybe the Thursday after the murder of George Floyd, and was like, it's probably time for you to like learn all about this stuff yourself, and also sort of like use this platform to have these conversations about what it means to be a black person in this music scene, to be a black person in our modern society. You know what I mean? And Austin does have one of those sort of like super liberal reputations, but when you live here, you see that everything's pretty segregated without anyone saying anything about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Austin's pretty racist.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a popular stance to take, but it is.
No, it is, yeah. Because it thinks of itself as not. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a part of it.
Yeah.
They've got, I shouldn't speak on it.
Well, I mean, it, basically what I was...
That's a rabbit hole that we could fall down.
Of course. But what I was going to ask you is that, like last summer, there was a surge of people, like in my position, broadening their knowledge in any way they can, be it, you know, the tons of documentaries that became available for free on all the platforms. And of course, you have nowhere to go, so you can, you know what I mean? Books your friends, turn you on to.
Yes, it was really encouraging.
It was. But let me ask you this. That lasted a lot of the summer. But then, like, the election things, you know what I mean? Was it a shiny object, and we were lucky that at that point people didn't have anything really to do except go out and protest? Or do you think that there was an actual awakening that has lasted some? Is it a step in the right direction?
No, it's a step in the right direction. I mean, I don't think that happened in vain. And I don't think that was some sort of tempest in a teapot. I mean, people could have stayed home. They didn't necessarily have to leave the house. And it was worldwide. It wasn't just New York or LA.
You're
people
right.
In Sweden were crying out loud. I mean, people all over the world. I think everyone woke up and realized it's everyone versus racists. It's really not about white people versus black people.
Right.
It's, you know, are you a racist? If you're not, then you're on my team. But you really do have to check your racism, and you have to check your privilege. And the fact that people started questioning that kind of thing, That's big.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was a big deal.
Yeah. I felt like at least, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You gotta start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And we needed like an actual step where people acknowledge systemic racism, not just, you know what I mean? Like how deeply it's ingrained into who we are as a society here.
Yeah.
Without us even knowing.
Yeah. I mean, I think a bigger part of it is each one, reach one, teach one. You really do have to make an to talk to your people, gather your people. Crazy Aunt Irma, when she starts saying wackadoo things about black people at Thanksgiving, or you know, whenever you see her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My dad hasn't talked to me since then. He was
really,
yeah. He was very, you know, he thought that I was conspiring with black people to take away the suburbs or whatever the hell people are fucking scared of. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, that goes back a long way, but I'm glad. I'd rather not hear him talk that shit. You know what I mean? Or bite my tongue or do anything like that that I ever did just to keep the peace in some way so that some guy could go around literally hurting other people and teaching his other children this wrong way of viewing the world. You know what I mean? So ultimately, I feel good.
Racists are really comfortable with their racism, and they're really loud and demonstrative.
Yes.
And when they're loud and demonstrative, we have to be as well.
Right, right.
I mean, yeah. You can't know that what you're doing is wrong if no one ever corrects you.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And people are really starting to learn history. I mean, actual, real.
Real history.
That's what happened, American history.
Yeah.
That is what happened.
Yeah. It's funny.
It's so outrageous, actually, that it's true, but it is.
Well, it took somebody like me watching that HBO show, Watchmen, to...
That blew my mind. Like, black people, Tulsa, you have to understand the riots of 1919, Tulsa was just a drop in the bucket. That was happening all over the United States in literally thousands of towns and hamlets and counties. Wilmington, North Carolina, you know what happened in Wilmington, right? Turn of the century. And black folk are prospering. They have their own businesses and they own their homes and their property and they're voting. And they literally voted the white folks that were in power out of power. And they stood up and said, well, we can't let this happen. So former Confederate soldiers came together with regular ordinary housewives and everybody grabbed a weapon and literally slaughtered black people. And the next day, after this massacre, 2,000 families left Wilmington, North Carolina. They just picked up and left. They left their property. They left their businesses. They left everything. And just went north. You literally had to constantly keep starting over again with everything.
As someone who was raised in the South, what is living in New York, how different is that racially? Just because it's so overwhelmingly diverse that there's not a lot of room for everything?
You know, I grew up in Atlanta, you know, in Charleston, just black, black, blackety black. Everything's black, you know? So I don't really know, there's not really a moment for me where there's not a whole lot of blackness going on. That's never been true in any part of my life. Even when I was in Austin, I knew where to find black people, where to find everything that I needed.
Right.
Even if it wasn't necessarily apparent to everybody else. There are places on campus where you can go that black people have renamed, like, you know, the Malcolm X room. you know, if you're going to stay in a specific dorm, the floor that all the black people are going to be living on. Right. I know that's true even now. When you go and register for what dorm you want to stay in, you know which floor to ask for if you're black, so that you'll be surrounded by black people.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's not, it's New York. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Everybody comes to New York and they sort of have this New York experience that sort of fulfills or replicates whatever New York experience they think they should be having. Times Square, the Lower East Side, you know, all that stuff. They just kind of build it out.
Right.
You know, and there are plenty of people, tour guides, who will help you do that. This is where James Dean used to live.
Right.
Or, you know, these are the best hot dogs, or let's go see the Bull on Wall Street. So you can be as much of a tourist or as little of a tourist as you want until the rest of it doesn't really exist. Like, there are lots of people who, like, never. There are people who are from here who've never been to Harlem.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like when you go there and visit your friends, they never have been to Times Square. Some of them have lived, or at least my friends are like, why would I go there? I don't want to meet Elmo.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I don't know. It's whatever New York you want to carve out for yourself.
Yeah.
Or whatever you want it to be. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know that I've given you a very clear idea of who I am or what I do here or what my New York is.
Well, I mean, I think I get a sense of who you are. You're an adventurous artist, creator, who, I guess whatever you're doing, be it music or acting or writing, you're being an artist, and it doesn't really matter the medium.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you artsy people.
If only I were artsy.
Things
would be a lot easier if I were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're an intense creator, is what I mean to say, right?
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. I just wish, I hope that I can give you a pretty good snapshot of where I live and all that good stuff, so that when someone listens to this, they're like, you know, Harlem is probably, I think, the only place in the city in Manhattan where you can still see the sky uninterrupted.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I look out my window and there's this blue sky. With other places, there's a building in the way. There's obstruction, but there's an ordinance that means you can't build buildings above a certain height up here.
Oh.
So you can still see, like, blue sky as you're walking around.
Right.
It's not what you think.
Right. Right. Real quick, as far as Guild the Black Lily, are you able to play at all yet? Or, like, how are you pushing this record outside of having a publicist and coming on shows like this? Are you doing live streams or anything?
I'm doing some live streams, but I don't really have that many planned.
Okay.
I should plan something for Instagram or something like that. I wish Concert Window was still around. You know, I could do something monthly. There's always some gig that's happening, but I'm probably going to do some sort of a live stream. There's a live stream situation in Brooklyn that's pretty cool.
Okay.
I'll be doing a Billie Holiday send up for her birthday on the 7th.
Oh, awesome.
All that information's on my, that's going to be cool, on my Facebook page.
Okay.
And on my website. What am I saying?
Yeah, queen-esther.com.
Yeah. You can go to queen-esther.com and if it's, it should be up. It should be up. If it's not up soon.
Is that April 7th that you're doing that?
Yeah,
April
7th.
This will be out after that, though. But people can still go to your website and connect with you on whatever social media platform they use the most and find out when you're doing more live stream stuff.
Absolutely. And if you want to see how the sausage is made, you can always join me on Ampled. It's like Patreon, but it's not commercial. And it's mostly, I think, musicians.
Really?
AMPLE. Yeah.
Do you have a link to that on your website as well?
I'll put it up.
Yeah. I would do that. That sounds great.
Yeah, I put up all kinds of things there. I put up recipes and books that I'm reading and stuff that tweaks me, pictures of Black Victorians, like everything that's rolling around, that's rolling past me that I'm boinking on. And I think I started it just so I could keep up with myself.
Right.
Just so I could sort of delineate and like make little notes and like, you know.
Yeah.
But sweet potato biscuits are good too.
I want to eat some of those. That sounds delicious.
I'm going to put up a recipe later on today for a 3-layer cornbread.
Oh God, that sounds amazing.
It magically divides itself into 3 layers when you bake it.
Wow.
I know.
That's amazing. Well, so people can get Gild the Black Lily and also all of your other records, like wherever they stream and download music, right?
Yeah. I'm on iTunes. I'm on Spotify.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I listen to you on Spotify.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate
just
that.
Today. Well, thank you so much for doing the show. People can find you at queen-esther.com. You can go there to find her information about when she's doing live streams. And of course, follow you, follow your music and I guess your acting as well.
Yeah. I mean, the theater that I'm doing, I'm probably going to be putting up in New York City, but you know, let's see what comes down the pike.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been really nice meeting you. And I'm sorry for all of the terrible connection issues, but maybe we can do this again someday in person.
Oh, I'd love that. That would be great.
Yeah, me too.
That would be without the wait.
What's that?
Can you see this?
Whoa, I see a beautiful blue. Oh, gorgeous. That's beautiful.
You can't really see it, can you?
No, I can see it. The blue sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Gorgeous.
That's Harlem. And there's my dog.
Aw, he's ready to go somewhere.
Yeah, he's been pacing in front of the door. He like started pacing just as soon as we got started.
Well, take him out. It was really nice meeting you.
Yeah, really nice meeting you too.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye, Esther.
Bye.
Stars ignite and make me hazy.
Queen Esther, her new album, Gild the Black Lily, available now wherever it is you stream and download your music. You can also find her on Bandcamp. That is the preferred method, because that way if you want to buy some music, you can. Buy some merch. People have albums and stuff. You can go to queen-esther.com for all of your Queen Esther needs. Great conversation, man. What a fantastically talented person. Also, thank you. If you're all the way at the end, then that means that you dealt with the little hiccups in there, the internet problems I had throughout that conversation. I fucking hate Zoom. I do, but I love Queen Esther. Get her album, Gild the Black Lily, now. Also, when you're out there checking out Gild the Black Lily, if you're doing it on Spotify, you can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, anywhere you find podcast news shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Great, great, great talking to Queen Esther. All right. Hope you guys have a great rest of the week. Let's get down.
Saddle gets no glory. questions.